It is time for the Media Beat from David Tereshchuk, his weekly review of media coverage for Robinhood Radio and exclusive to Robinhood Radio. David is a multimedia and international journalist with his own online column at themediabeat.us. And as a special correspondent since 2012, he has contributed TV reports to the PBS network, mostly on ethical issues. Here's David.
This is David Tereshchuk with the Media Beat for the weekend beginning July 12th, 2024. Election news first, but let's take a break, shall we, from American media's biggest preoccupation, the high point or low point of yesterday's White House press conference. I mean, of course, the Democratic Party's restiveness and confusion over their president being or not being the best person to articulate his own record in office and lead them into victory, reinstalling him in that office. I'll take a break, but I will be coming back to that issue. It's inevitable. Instead, for now, I want to look at this year of elections overall. 2024 began with the media beating the drum to announce what was called the biggest election year ever. That was true globally, though some of the more isolationist American outlets were applying the label to only the U.S., true globally in that an unparalleled number of 70-plus countries would be holding national elections this year, with a total of roughly half the world's adult population going into the voting booths at various points between January and December. Now that we've passed the year's halfway mark, how are the results looking to the media? Voting in just the past couple of weeks has brought tumultuous drama and upheaval internationally, enough to excite even the most blasé of globe-trotting reporters. I can cite the upheavals of the United Kingdom that I talked about in full last week. In France, perhaps aptly just in time for its national day this weekend, and even in, dare I say, a country that's hardly renowned for its democratic processes, Iran. France and Iran don't have much in common, though we could recall that Ayatollah Khomeini spent years preparing the revolution that would make him supreme leader of Iran from a base just west of Paris. What the two countries have just displayed in two rounds of voting, both countries held two rounds, was possibly best described as the spook factor, not in the meaning of spying, but of scaring and being scared, spooked. In France, the first round of voting raised very seriously the alarming prospect of a lurch in the National Assembly toward the extreme right, in the shape of the National Rally Party, which was previously the National Front, the longtime home of Nazi sympathizers. That first round ended with National Rally taking the lead, looking poised to win the most assembly seats of any party, and three times as many as it previously held. This definitely spooked the nation. And swiftly, a tactical coalition of necessity was created between a broad left alliance and President Macron's more centrist party, which in the end, at the second round of voting, beat the far right down to third place. It was a surprise victory by the left and center parties, confounding many pessimistic predictions in the media about the extreme right being dangerously close to taking power. Meanwhile, in Iran, first-round spooking happened there when the people's evident choice crystallized between a hardliner, Saeed Jalili, and a reformist candidate, Masoud Pezeshkian, reformist being a relative term in establishment Iranian politics. After recent years of increased repression, much of it centering on brutal enforcement of women's headscarf-wearing laws, Pezeshkian actually campaigned on a promise to relax that enforcement. Jalili, for his part, promised what he called strength, and his campaigning generally emphasized greater national security. In the second round, Pezeshkian won. An analyst with the International Crisis Group defined the choice this way. Votes for Pezeshkian were not so much out of hope for the better, but fear of the worse with Jalili. Significantly, the low turnout in the first electoral round of only 40%, the undeniable sign of a jaundiced population altogether, surged substantially to 50% in the second round, and that helped the reformists to win the presidency. Nobody could claim this improved turnout was any kind of rousing endorsement for the entire electoral process, still less confidence in the system of government as a whole, where the current supreme leader has way more power than the newly elected president, but it was a telling response to the choice available to the Iranian people at this point. In France's case, the turnout for the second round surged to 60%, a level not seen since 1981, and a 20-point leap compared with the last assembly election. So the spooking effect was a major engine for increased electoral participation in both France and Iran. It might be worth reflecting, though, on decreased participation in Britain, the country that has often claimed to be the cradle of parliamentary democracy. The vote that tossed out the Conservatives' Rishi Sunak and brought in the Labour Party's Keir Starmer was the result of a turnout amounting to 60%. That may be larger than Iran's and on a par with France's, but it still represents a drop of 2% since the last British election. Nobody, not even the most eager Labour supporter, can credibly paint that Starmer victory as representing an enthusiastic embrace by the electorate. The instances of low-trending turnouts, which got shaken into abrupt change in France and Iran only by some rude awakening to a looming political emergency, should make us ponder America's status in this regard. Voter engagement in the U.S. is generally regarded among international analysts as unimpressive, with its voter turnout in the late 20th century and into the 21st hovering at percentages that ranged through just the 50s and low 60s. American turnout has certainly trailed behind many advanced societies. Other English-speaking electorates, like Australia and New Zealand, have been substantially ahead of the U.S., both of them in the upper 70s percentages. We should remember, though, that voting is, of course, compulsory in Australia. On the other hand, New Zealanders show up to vote without legal compulsion, though their good rate has slowly started to slide downward in recent years. Disenchantment with politics overall has been blamed, which of course sounds familiar, throughout many of the world's democracies. But, and here's a serious significant but, and a relatively recent but at that, the American elections of 2018, 2020, and 2022 were three of the highest turnout elections for decades in their respective category, general and presidential, or midterms. About two-thirds, 66% of voting-eligible Americans turned out for the 2020 presidential election, the first Biden-Trump contest, and that was the highest rate for any national election since 1900. The 2018 election, with a 49% turnout, had the highest rate for a midterm since 1914. Even the 2022 turnout, with a slightly lower rate of 46%, exceeded that of all midterm elections since 1970. We can certainly see the effect of a political emergency registering with the American electorate. And here's where the current Democratic leadership dilemma forces its way into our attention again. The emergency now, the extra high stakes, as every Democrat taking to the airwaves this week has been phrasing it, the defeat of Donald Trump, a convicted felon and a complete liar who threatens the very continuance of American democracy, has been invoked as the reason for both sticking with Joe Biden, the man who has beaten Trump once, and for replacing Biden with someone who can more forcefully make the case against Trump. This coming week, we'll see Trump himself brought under more media scrutiny again, as the Republicans crown him in their Milwaukee convention. And when I say scrutiny, I hope to mean real scrutiny, along with, we can but hope, an abandoning of the double standard that's been at work here so far. A full-court press over Biden's evident weaknesses, as opposed to almost haphazard coverage of Trump's form of mental degeneration. It's too easy for the media to dismiss Trump's ramblings as crazy and a bit weird. For instance, those extraordinary, self-involved imaginings of his while on stage at a Las Vegas rally that he'd invented a method for electrocuting to death a killer shark. claiming some kind of expertise because he has a remote connection via a now-deceased uncle to MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. This was not merely weird. It was, to cite that especially acute monitor of Trump, The Atlantic magazine, it was a visceral demonstration of a mind that is deeply unwell. Let's hope the Republican convention prompts the media in general to fully carry out their job of close scrutiny, and maybe they'll help to produce, down the road 4 months from now, a meaningful surge in voter turnout, with the American electorate fully awakened to just how momentous, how much of an emergency their choice is this year. That's all from the Media Beat this week. If you have been, thanks for listening.
Thank you very much, David. We will talk to you next week. David can be found at themediabeat.us.